I think I should warn you all. When a vampire bites it, it's never a pretty sight. No two bloodsuckers go out the same way. Some yell and scream, some go quietly. Some explode, some implode. But all will try to take you with.
Catapult and propaganda.
Alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert. And welcome to, let's see, what is today's date? I've lost track of time.
Today is the 9th of July, 2006.
It is the 9th of July, and you know what? That's one day shy of July 10th, which, of course, in the bunker.
Yes.
Is a big day.
It is. Tomorrow is the day we evacuate.
We're bugging out tomorrow.
No, this is the last time.
If you're listening, you know that we are moving. Tomorrow is the big day. We've loaded up the truck. It's sitting in the street outside of the bunker. And, well, white fans galore going by trying to figure
yes.
out what secrets might be.
What's going on in there? Well,
sort of tinfoil hats are in there.
This is the last time you'll hear from us from this location. Supplies are running out.
No.
We don't know how much longer we can hold on.
And Krispy Kreme.
No, we've got most of the important things loaded up. There are still some things here, like the computer, obviously. Otherwise, we wouldn't be recording this right now.
Yeah, but we are taking this with us tomorrow.
That's right. Yeah, it's one of the last things that'll get loaded in. And then we make the drive about 90 miles west and offload again with the help of a couple of volunteers that have been conscripted from the new
volunteers with pony marks around them.
Yes. So anyway, we're going to get the show together tonight. We won't have any blather for you because we just have not been paying attention to the news. We've been too busy this week.
Well, what's that I hear? Someone going, yay!
Yeah. Shut up. Get to the interview.
Well, the interview is coming up, but we want to thank everybody. We've noticed on the forum that some of you are, you know, really thinking about what we're going through, and we appreciate that. We appreciate your prayers. Anyone who has ever moved, especially moved a household, you know, it stinks. There's just the only thing good about this is that Derek's going to a job he's gonna love.
Mm.
We get to move to a town that is just looks like it's going to be a whole lot of fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are a lot of poignant aspects to this, too. Further away from Nicole.
That's true. That's for the short run, anyway.
Yeah.
It's very possible that come a couple of years down the road, she may decide to attend university there in Columbia.
You never know.
So
you never know.
It's possible.
Well, anyway, we did want to come down here. We talked briefly upstairs. Should we just put the interview up and not have any kind of a wrap at all, no blather? So we decided that since this is the last PID cast coming from the bunker here in St. Louis, we thought we'd better do it right.
Well, don't forget that the tinfoil hat contest.
No, we haven't. We haven't
still
been on the air. It's still, and July 31st
is rapidly
last
approaching.
Day.
Mm-hmm.
So 21 days away. 22 days. 22.
Yes. Make sure you get that entry in, and basically we just need a JPEG or some sort of an image file of you
please
modeling
don't send an IMAP
your hat. Yeah. Do not, or yes, no bitmap or TIFF images, please. That will automatically disqualify.
IMAP?
Yes.
Sorry.
Don't.
No, I meant bitmap.
And no IMAX images either.
Well,
those are really hard to email.
They're
and really
big.
Large. Yeah. So don't send those. But
IMAX?
Your JPEG, yes, GIF or whatever else you want to use is just fine. If it's even a movie file, perhaps as long as it's small.
Just remember, it's relatively small. You don't want to send a huge file via your email. Our service provider doesn't want us to grab.
Yeah, yeah. But send that along. We're looking for the funniest, the most original, and the most high tech tinfoil hat. And just by submitting your entry, you become a member of the Illuminati.
That's right. And you want that Illuminati membership card.
Yes.
Yes, we're going to have one. They may or may not be laminated. We don't know. They may be covered in tinfoil.
In fact, we may just post an image file to the internet, let you download it and cut it out. But we will have a card for you. Anyway, we've got a great interview with Paul Collins and Philip Collins. They've got a new and revised edition of their book, The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, and we thought that's a topic that deserved to be revisited because it's about the control of what we think.
Boy, controlling what we think. I can't imagine that. Can you imagine that?
I can't imagine it. This is all nuts. In fact, we should just give this up right now. What are we thinking? We must be loonies.
I know. Well, listen, if you're listening to this now, you'd better well be thinking about controlling people trying to control what you're thinking.
Wait a minute. Or else what? Yoink.
Okay, getting goofy. I need just to go chill.
We need to go relax.
Long day.
Lifting and hauling a lot of stuff today. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, without further ado, we're going to go right to that interview you're all waiting for and thinking, shut up, please, people. It is the famous Frog Brothers, Paul and Philip Collins.
Paul David Collins has authored the book The Hidden Face of Terrorism, The Dark Side of Social Engineering from Antiquity to September 11th, a book that was edited by his brother Philip Darrell Collins. The two of them have collaborated on the book The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, an Examination of Epistemic Autocracy from the 19th to the 21st Century, a new and revised edition of which is now available. Paul, Philip, welcome back to PID Radio.
Thanks for having us, Derek.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
Well, let's dive into the bones of the book. What is the premise that you are outlining in The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship?
Well, as we look backwards in history, we find that the power elites, the ruling class, whether it be the elites of Babylon or Egypt or any number of the other ancient oligarchies, were able to maintain a system of control, manipulation, and strict regimentation, the establishment of their day, if you will, through religious institutions and mysticism. In particular, one of the most prominent of those was the institution of sun worship, whether under the appellation of Osiris or Set or the numerous other appellations that that institution assumed. You will recall, for instance, Jesus Christ, when he challenged the Pharisees in the book of John, chapter 7, the officers who have been sent to seize Jesus come back empty-handed, and the chief priests and Pharisees demand to know why. They explain that no man had ever spoke like Jesus spoke. And in verse 48, the Pharisees and chief priest reply, "Have any of the rulers or the Pharisees believed on him?" Unquote. Well, what's implied through this statement that the Pharisees make is that something is not true until the Pharisees told the people that it was true.
Hmm.
You don't believe until they believe, and they tell you it's all right to believe. So what you have basically here is what Paul and I dub an epistemological cartel. Epistemology is basically the study of knowledge and what is constitutive of knowledge. It's derived from the Greek root episteme, which means knowledge or knowing. Basically, an epistemological cartel basically monopolizes knowledge and also acts as the ultimate arbiter of what constitutes knowledge. Now, in the past, it was the epistemological cartels of the past would basically arbitrate on what was legitimate knowledge based on their alleged communion with suprasensible entities. Now, today, ironically, the new epistemological cartels arbitrate on what constitutes legitimate knowledge based on the rejection of suprasensible entities. Basically, they've relocated all epistemological primacy and metaphysical primacy to this ontological plane of existence, the physical universe. But now, this particular form of manipulation started losing its effectiveness with the decline of the elite's theocratic power structures. So the theocratic power structures of the elite, of course, had to undergo extensive epistemic overhaul. The whole thing went through what can only be described as an epistemic transformation, and the result was the emergence of the concept of a scientific dictatorship. Now, the philosophical underpinnings and foundations of the power elite's religion stayed intact, but assumed a secular and scientific appearance. We owe this in large part to Darwin, whose evolutionary theory was used to scientifically legitimate the thinking of several individuals that can be described as theoreticians for the power elite. To name a few, you have Adam Weishaupt, the founder of the infamous Illuminati, Karl Marx, father of communism or supposed father of communism, Voltaire, Diderot, Rousseau, and the list goes on. But Darwinism was used to micromanage the crusade for a scientific dictatorship.
So this period of history that you're talking about, during this transformation from the religious orientation of this epistemological cartel to a scientific, and I put that in quoting marks, orientation, was what, the Enlightenment period?
The Enlightenment was in large part a good portion of that segue period. The real transformative period, I guess you could say it began to take place with the Enlightenment, and it really accelerated around 1662 through the British Royal Society, which was founded under a royal warrant from Charles II.
But a parenthetical aside here, this attempt to erect a dictatorship justified by science is a conspiracy, but you need to dislodge your brain from what Chris Carter has presented to you and what so-called researchers such as David Icke tend to reinforce. This is not some monolithic, omnipotent conspiracy with a single man or a group sitting astride the capstone of the pyramid.
And no lizard men?
No lizard men.
Oh.
Or one that I am I'm getting quite tired of. I have very little forbearance for, and it's getting very taxing on my patience, is this idea that was very popular a few years back and is starting to reemerge, this idea that it's this network of Jesuits controlling everything, working to put the Pope on the throne as the papal Caesar over the entire world.
Although Jesuitism does play an integral role.
But... Yeah, it does play an integral role, but you can also find that there's a considerable amount of competition there between the Jesuits and masonry, and just there's a lot of factionalism involved.
It's funny you should mention that, and once we get done with the interview, we'll need to talk about the movie The Rock, starring Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery, because we see that whole movie as a metaphor for the struggle between the Jesuits and the Freemasons. But that is another story. We digress.
Sure.
Anyway.
Oh, yeah. But this is not a monolithic conspiracy like I was saying. It's largely a conspiracy of ideas. Conspiratorial groups consciously promulgate the continuity of thought within their own circles. And the continuity of thought is disseminated under several different appellations on the popular level. Thus, secular humanism and the New Age movement, which was both manufactured by factions of the power elite, seem to be on different trajectories, but they reach what is essentially the same end. The conspiracy becomes kind of an unconscious ideational contagion at the level of public consumption. Conscious agents of the conspiratorial tradition stick around to shepherd things and to periodically enter the picture to make sure the ideational contagion doesn't get derailed. But for the most part, the power elite simply start the ball rolling and we do the rest. So shame on us.
Yeah. But at any rate, the term scientific dictatorship, which, by the way, was coined by Aldous Huxley, who was basically the son of a oligarchical dynasty out of England, and also was mentored under H.G. Wells, who was a Fabian socialist, allegedly a Freemason, a member of the Secretive Coefficients Club, and other elitist organizations, and whose grandfather was Charles Darwin's chief apologist, and also played an integral role in the founding of the Cecil Rhodes Roundtable organizations. Aldous Huxley was the one that coined the term scientific dictatorship. But scientific dictatorship is a term that can be used interchangeably with the term technocracy. Now, technocracy, the term seems to have been coined in 1919 by an American engineer named William Henry Smith. But the concept of a technocracy, or this rule by scientists and engineers, but basically a cognitive elite, self-proclaimed experts. The concept can be traced back to Sir Francis Bacon in the 17th century. Bacon basically systematized the principles of technocratic governance and assembled them into a comprehensive tome that he titled The New Atlantis, which was published in 1627. Interestingly enough, The New Atlantis was basically adorned, the book was adorned with esoteric symbols of occult Freemasonry. And Freemasonry is the organizational retainer of the ancient mystery religion that originated in Mesopotamia, specifically in Babylon and Egypt, well over 6,000 years ago. So Bacon adhered to this occult tradition, and the contention can be reinforced when one considers his tutelage in Gnosticism, Kabbalism, Hermeticism, and Neoplatonism. In fact, Bacon was a member of a secret society called the Order of the Helmet, which got its name from the Greek goddess of wisdom, Pallas Athene. And the goddess of wisdom is a recurring esoteric motif within the occult secret societies, which represents science and the cognitive powers of man as the chief facilitators of humanity's salvation.
Does that derive from the Gnostic Sophia?
Absolutely, absolutely. Sophia is just a reiteration of the same occult motif, and you see it now, now today, at, for instance, Denver University and the Denver University mural, the digital transformation. They have yet again another mural featuring the goddess, and again, the idea being communicated here is the primacy of the cognitive powers of man as being the chief facilitators for man's ultimate salvation, which, again, that's a Gnostic doctrine. That, mm-hmm. That's the idea of self-salvation is basically a doctrine that is Gnostic. But these ideas, if they sound familiar, they were very much present during the 19th century. They basically constituted what James Billington called the Promethean faith of the 19th century revolutionaries like Marx and the Russians of Lenin's time. In fact, many people have characterized the communist movement, the Nazis, fascism, communism, as basically secular Gnosticism. Now, these socio-political utopians, which constituted secular Gnostics, were basically attempting to, in Gnostic terminology, immanentize the eschaton on this ontological plane of existence, or in layman's terms, basically create heaven on earth. But in Bacon's New Atlantis, readers will find the mandate for a society governed by scientists and engineers. They'll also discover the mandate for the formation of an invisible college, and this invisible college was realized with the formation of the British Royal Society in 1660. And the Royal Society was the outgrowth of the Lunar Society, which was presided over by several technocrats, but chiefly by Erasmus Darwin, who was a Freemason and the grandfather of Charles Darwin. And, of course, Erasmus developed a precursory theory of Darwinism, precursory theory of evolution, working off of several earlier models. Evolutionary thought, evolutionary theory, is basically just derivative of an older occult doctrine known as transformism, the idea that humanity is inherently mutable, that humanity can be changed, so that humanity will actually transcend its own humanity and, in Nietzschean terms, if you will, overcome its humanity and become something else, enter this post-human condition where humanity will cease being human, but will become a god. But at any rate, Darwinism became one of the edifying sciences of all the 20th century scientific dictatorships, communism, fascism. And Darwinism itself functions as a Gnostic myth because it denies the transcendent origin of being. It validates the metaphysical claim of self-creation, which, by the way, is derivative of the old Kabbalistic legend of the Golem, which was supposedly a synthetic man created from non-living matter.
I don't think most people who believe in the the idea that matter was that life was created well basically created itself the Darwinist belief of creation. Understand the irony of this. I mean, here we are supposed to believe that there are only natural causes. Causes to life here on Earth, and yet in order for the process to begin, you have to have dead matter somehow willing itself to live.
Absolutely, and the only way that you could ever really do that is invoking some supra-sensible cause. I mean, Sir Francis Crick attempted to, reconcile the problem by introducing little green men. But then that begs the question, who created the little green men?
Right. Now, Crick, of course, is the co-discoverer of DNA, so he's not some hack.
Absolutely, absolutely. But at any rate, the Gnosticism and Darwinism, again, functioning as a Gnostic myth, Gnosticism comprised a portion of the Masonic belief system, and this is significant because the British Royal Society, which promoted Darwinism, was arguably a Masonic institute from the very beginning. Virtually all of its founding members were Freemasons. Thus, the science that these men promoted was probably synchronized with their Gnostic beliefs. So Darwinism was precisely such a science. Also, Darwinism provided the scientific foundation for Masonry's sociopolitical utopianism. And, of course, that utopianism would be translated into the crusaders of secular Gnosticism, such as communism and fascism. But to give you an idea of where I'm headed with this, both Marx and Hitler find their philosophical roots with none other than George Friedrich Hegel, whose early work was influenced by Gnostic Kabbalist Christoph Oettinger. Now, of course, Hegel would develop the dialectic, the Hegelian dialectic, which Marx would redirect towards the realm of socioeconomics. But the Hegelian dialectic is basically a strategy of ideological divide and conquer. It involves polarizing the masses with conflicting ideologies which are incrementally synthesized into a single ideational entity with the worst features of the two opposing camps. For instance, the dialectic of monopolistic capitalism against communism is ending in a sort of feudal corporatism, or the earlier dialectic of communism against fascism resulted in internationalism. Even earlier than that, the dialectic of the Protestant Reformation, which had good, well-meaning Christians involved, but also occult forces were subverting their efforts. That they comprised this dialectic with the Catholics and basically the Catholics' counter-reformation, which was headed up by none other than the Jesuits, which basically were also, inspired by occult secret societies. But that synthesized to birth the secular state. But all of these dialectical syntheses are progressing towards a great synthesis, an emanticized eschaton on this ontological plane of existence. In geopolitical terminology, that would equate to a one-world socialist totalitarian government. And this is basically why we have seen the promulgation of continuous war throughout history, is because all political science and governance has been subsumed under Darwinian theory, under evolutionary theory, and thus has assumed a dialectical character.
That's really interesting when you think about it, because what you're describing is an attempt to create through geopolitical means, enacted through a means of control over the common man through religious and educational means, a reversal of the principle of entropy.
Absolutely.
Rather than things disintegrating and falling apart, becoming less organized over time,
right.
We're trying to see a reversal of that and a collaboration, a congealing of everything back into one.
Absolutely. And it creates a geopolitical climate that is automatically, conceptually predisposed to conflict. It creates a geopolitical climate that automatically makes a war basically almost an inevitability, because Darwinian theory is actually dialectical in nature, and it has subsumed political science and governance underneath itself.
when you start to look at things from the and see how this Hegelian principle has been employed, it starts to basically crumble and strip away what we've been taught by the various talking heads and the different pontificating airheads that you see on the news channels, namely Hannity, Combs, Ann Coulter, James Carville. These people present to their audiences this very simple dualistic kind of situation, and in the liberals' mind, it's the good liberals against the evil conservatives, and then in the conservative mind, it's the good conservatives against the evil liberals. And when you discover this Hegelian principle in play in the whole framework of things, you start to see that it is not this simple dualistic kind of struggle going on, but instead what you have is basically dueling going on between two or more criminal syndicates. And the saying that Lily Tomlin used to say starts to take on a whole new meaning, and you start to get a more appreciation for it. She used to say, "The more cynical I get, I just can't keep up." it really does fit things if you think about it.
Well put. We're talking with the only two men I know who can use phrases like Can you help me out here? Epistemological cartel, ideational contagion, and eminentizing the eschaton and mean it. One of the really bizarre things about the premise of your book, The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship, is that we've seen, and what you detail, is the transformation of a system of control by power elites who you go from using religion and religious means to keep people controlled and pacified throughout most of history until the time roughly of the Enlightenment, at which time we see the power elites begin to use science as a means of guiding popular thought and geopolitical change. And yet, you describe the groups who are leading this change and who control the way we learn and what we think as still devoted to these occult-based belief systems. How do you rationalize that? How do you bring this to – let me ask it this way. Why are these groups that appear to believe in these occultic pseudo-religious structures or whatever you want to call them teaching people or presenting themselves to the public as secularists?
Well, I think because basically the inevitable philosophical outcome of an exclusively secular worldview is inevitably mystical in character, is inevitably occult in character. To give you an example, for instance, one of the dominant epistemological paradigms that governs modern science is radical empiricism. Okay, empiricism is basically the epistemological position holding that knowledge is derived exclusively from the senses. Now, ironically, this doctrine of sense certainty is no less mystical in character than its religious counterparts.
So what you're saying then is the belief that if I can't measure it by seeing it with my own eyes through or observing the needles moving on these instruments over here, then it doesn't really exist?
Exactly.
Okay.
And to give you an example of what it does, okay, David Hume, who was a radical empiricist and an Enlightenment thinker, showed how an exclusively empirical approach basically relegated causality, that is, cause and effect relationships, to the realm of metaphysical fantasy. Now, you can demonstrate temporal succession, that is, two phenomena occurring in a definite sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also demonstrate spatial proximity, or two phenomena occurring in the same vicinity.
Okay.
But you cannot demonstrate a causal connection. What's perceived as A causing B could merely be a circumstantial juxtaposition. So in the absence of causation,
all of the scientists' findings require an investment of metaphysical faith. But ironically enough, they would have us believe that that their findings represent objective, objective absolute truth.
Okay, so what you're saying then is if we conduct this experiment and we see that when we do A, B usually follows, then we can believe that A causes B, but we cannot be certain with 100%.
Absolutely. We can say there is probability. Basically, they substitute the word faith with probability.
Okay.
And probability becomes the dominant ruling cohesive force of what is essentially their religion. And this is why science has its place. It has its place and it has its part. But science it basically is derived from the Latin root scientia, which means knowing.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it depends on what epistemological paradigms they are basically lending primacy to. What and if you basically hand it over to sense certainty, which is what happened with the shift from the 19th to the 20th century, actually a little bit earlier than that with the Enlightenment. With with radical empiricism, you are no less exchanging one form of mysticism for another, and no one form of knowing can be considered more reliable than another. I mean, I don't see where rationalism versus empiricism, where either one of those exclusively by themselves promise absolute objective, you know, truthful view of things.
What I like to do is I like to turn the different philosophical students of philosophy on their heads by saying, well, atheism is not a disbelief in deity, it is a belief in emergent deity. Because if you say that, that with any amount of certainty that there is no God, then you're claiming to be all-knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And the only being in the universe that could have the attribute of being all-knowing would be a God. So it goes back to what Malcolm Muggeridge, the famous journalist, used to say. He said, if God is dead, then somebody has to take his place. So you've basically relocated, you've basically placed yourself on the throne of the God that you just, in your own mind, killed.
And that's precisely what this process, this gradual process of secularization, has been designed to do. It's been designed to relocate our attribution of deity from a supra-sensible, omniscient, omnipotent God outside the ontological plane of the physical universe to man himself, thus reiterating the mantra of Protagoras, man is the measure of all things. And that you see this throughout all history, throughout all the various scientific dictatorships. And in Nazi Germany, which was a scientific dictatorship, you had the Aryan, who was the new God man. In communist Russia, they called him the Soviet man. You see it emerging today with several other futurist sects of the ruling class religion that have actually subsumed the ruling class religion. For instance, transhumanism and the idea of this machine man, which bears ominous resemblance to the idea that Adam Weishaupt developed with the Illuminati, known as the machine dimension or the machine man. But basically the idea that man will evolve and progress to a point beyond his humanity, as Nietzsche put it, overcoming his humanity and become something else, thus becoming God.
And the goal of the ancient mysteries was always the apotheosis of man, man's deification. So what we were supposedly moving away from, we've in fact moved right back towards, in spite of ourselves, I guess you could say. So that's why it's still, you know, while looking to like it's secular, like it's strictly scientific, it still has all these occult properties, as you pointed out, Derek.
So let's go back to the British Royal Society. Do you think
Sure.
that this was their plan right from the start, was to create a means by which they could start moving the general public in the direction of this belief system in apotheosis?
Absolutely. In fact, I believe that, for instance, there was an inner core of people behind the British Royal Society, known as the X Club, which was presided over by none other than T.H. Huxley. And again, T.H. Huxley ran in conspiratorial circles. He was one of the people who was involved in the formation of the Cecil Rhodes Roundtable Group, or organizations, which would later on form the Royal Institute for International Affairs, which would form a stateside branch here in the United States known as the Council on Foreign Relations, which has basically become this country's foreign policy cartel. They arbitrate on matters of foreign policy. But at any rate, T.H. Huxley presided over this X Club, and the X Club basically made sure that undesirable news, news that did not basically favor their own worldview, their own scientific conclusions, did not make it to the mainstream press. In fact, when some very, very disturbing news arose regarding the supposed discovery of Haeckel's Monera, it turned out that in fact it was not it was not one of the original progenitors of life. It was not it was not what Haeckel called the Monera. It was not the intermediate form of life from non-living matter. Basically, T.H. Huxley and the X Club made sure that none of the press, none of the foreign or domestic press, spread it around too much.
And now, so, Haeckel, wasn't Haeckel the guy that developed that famous drawing that we've all seen in our biology texts that showed the stages of the growth of a human embryo, and which it passed through all of those stages where it looked like a little gilled creature, yeah, and then like a fish, and then a lizard, and
yeah, and those gill slits, by the way, they disappear into the walls of the throat, and they have no connection to the respiratory system.
Well, it basically turned out that the drawing was a hoax, and it's known to have been a hoax for over 75 years, and yet I still remember seeing that drawing in my biology textbook from grade school.
Absolutely.
So this was the Haeckel that you're talking about here.
Absolutely. This is also. This is also the same Haeckel who's I believe the term for the Monera that was supposedly discovered was the Basidius Haeckeli, if I'm not mistaken. But this supposed primordial, the primordial life turned out being nothing more than gypsum. And it was rock, gay,
drywall.
Of course,
I've been working with painting Monera all afternoon here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure working within the confines of their mystical belief system, though that's not beyond the realm of possibility, because rocks are dead as doornails, and yet they claim that man comes from dead matter.
That's right.
But again, they made sure that the press did not circulate this news too much. And the X Club basically constituted that day and age's media cartel, kind of like a Rupert Murdoch little setup there with T.H. Huxley himself acting as a Rupert Murdoch over the scientific press.
It's also interesting to note that Desmond Moore, who is a Darwinian, who is one of the scholars that is a foremost expert on Darwin and on the history of Darwin's theory, in his writings has referred to the X Club as T.H. Huxley's Masonic Club.
Yeah, and T.H. Huxley himself was a Freemason. So, again, you're seeing where these people's heritage comes from.
So what steps did they take then to impose their particular view of teaching knowledge, imparting knowledge to schooling into the educational system of England and then the United States?
Well, to give you an idea of where they took it, again, you had this ongoing assault on the evangelical establishment. And by the way, the Christian establishment at the time was weak enough as is, because prior to that, you had basically this little Hegelian dialectic promulgated within Christendom by occult secret societies. The Protestant Reformation, again, which had many well-meaning good Christians involved in it who wanted to basically reform the church and basically break away from the corruption of the Catholic system.
Mm-hmm.
The Protestant Reformation, nonetheless, was controlled in part by certain members of occult secret societies, such as the Rosicrucians. In fact, I believe Martin Luther's seal.
Yes, mm-hmm. his personal seal had two symbols that were important to the Rosicrucian order: the rose and the cross.
Really?
And And he believed he subscribed to the idea of nominalism.
Yes. And nominalism rejects man's ability to abstract. And what abstraction is basically man's ability to look at the sensible world, the sensible objects of this world, and extrapolate from it transcendent principles, and extrapolate from those transcendent principles a transcendent God. Paul the Apostle even uses abstraction. In the scriptures, he says that all of the visible world is a testament to the invisible God.
Right.
Because we derive from, for instance, you drive from a house, you look at a house, a sensible object, a house, and you drive from it right angles, mathematical principles, all those things that went into it. Those things are supra-sensible entities, but they are no less real because they can be tangibly enacted on this physical plane of existence. And we know then from those transcendent principles that we can derive from those transcendent principles the originator of those transcendent principles, which is God.
Sure.
But nominalism, which Martin Luther adhered to, basically rejected man's abilities to abstract and kind of moved Christianity onto the trajectory of materialism, of radical empiricism, basically a more secular trajectory.
Well, let's not downplay too the importance of the exodus of thousands of Puritans from England in the early part of the 17th century to the new colonies in Massachusetts Bay, which left those Christians behind in the United Kingdom of a sort that were a little more willing to accommodate the existing Church of England.
Right, absolutely. And meanwhile, on the other hand, on the other end, you had the Counter-Reformation, which was spearheaded by none other than the Jesuits. And the Jesuits were basically founded by a mystic,
Ignatius Loyola.
Yes, mm-hmm. Ignatius Loyola, whose beliefs were no less occult in character than those of many of the Protestant Reformation leaders. And the Jesuits, basically the Jesuit system and Jesuit thinking has been used and reiterated time and time again by socio-political utopians, for instance, the Illuminati, Adam Weishaupt's infamous Illuminati, basically used a Jesuit system of control. Also, the Jesuit system of control was adopted by the military establishment for the temporal, the spatial and chronemic regulation of its personnel, because the Jesuits were extremely authoritarian in nature, and ironically enough, a deceased Marxist philosopher by the name of Michel Foucault wrote extensively on how the Jesuit authoritarian system of control had been basically subsumed by society itself, and has led to the emergence of what you could call a panoptic society, or a carceral culture, a culture that is literally a prison system.
Mm.
But these two controlled dialectical extremes, the Protestant Reformation and the Counter-Reformation of the Catholic Church, basically helped to weaken and eventually destroy Christendom. Divide and conquer. And as a result, it was not difficult for ideas such as those promulgated by the British Royal Society to eventually come to power, because Christendom's chief apologists and chief ideologues really really didn't have much in the way of prominence or influence after that point.
Erasmus of Rotterdam, who was a Christian humanist, had warned Luther that if he kept on going the way that he was, that he would essentially destroy Christendom, that he'd bring Christendom down. And he said to Luther, he said, look, I agree with you. The sacraments are nonsense. You know, most of this stuff is just human tradition. But what you're doing is you're basically destroying the foundations and the establishment that could act as an umbrella for Christian civilization, and you're going to basically bring about something that is completely secular in nature, and that's what's happened over there.
Yeah.
If you look at the European Union, they want nothing to do. They want nothing having to do remotely at all with God in their constitution. And
I think the most recent survey I saw showed that about 5% of the people in the northern European nations attend church even once a month.
Yeah.
Not that that's an absolute identifier for true Christians, but it is at least a clue.
Yeah, and it's starting to hurt things over there really, really bad. We're having a bad demographic bleed in Europe. Their fertility levels are down, and they're experiencing a population implosion. And we can attribute a lot of that to eugenical programs, to sterilization, to abortion, to those sorts of things. But you also have to take into consideration the fact that people who, sociologically speaking, when people aren't having that many children, it's because they don't have any hope for the future.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and Christianity provided a hope for the future. The fact that most of them do not even subscribe to Christianity now, they have no hope for the future, so that's the point in having children.
Looking ahead now to the future, under the scientific dictatorship, this epistemic autocracy, where is all of this leading?
Well, you can see the future in what the epistemic transformation did to the elites, because the epistemic transformation affected the elites as much as it affected society on the whole. The result of the epistemic transformation was a much more vicious breed of elite. And this new breed can be described as a socio-political Darwinian. And the socio-political Darwinians are globalists who believe political, economic, so in social interdependence is a result of evolution. Interdependence is one of evolution's progressive functions.
Yeah, it's a natural outcome of political evolution.
So they believe that Darwin's theory doesn't just apply to physical origins of man. It also applies to nations, corporations, and all socio-political arrangements. So that brings us to the topic of warfare. And that's where we're headed. That's where you can see that just by watching the news nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we have a socio-political Darwinian elite dominating the affairs of man, we can expect to experience a climate of perpetual warfare. Now, in his book, The Power Elite, sociologist C. Wright Mills tells us that the power elite direct the military establishment. And the power elite, they make sure that key positions in the military establishment are occupied by what you could term our Darwinian militarist. Now, a Darwinian militarist believes that the universal biological laws have ruled war as an inevitability. War is the necessary competition between humans that leads to biological adaptation and progress. So you can't remove war from human society and expect humanity to reach its evolutionary end, which is a God-man. William Graham Sumner, a very famous sociologist, put it this way, quote, "It is the Darwinian competition for life which makes war, and that is why war has always existed and always will," unquote. And you peace activists out there who feel you're simply banging your heads against the wall right now, consider this. These guys are essentially evolutionary Calvinists, if you will. The Darwinian militarists believe war is biologically determined. Biological processes predetermine that we are going to fight with one another. Human free will is so obliterated in the Darwinian militarist mind, forget it. You can't choose peace. War is in your genes. But what you can do is manage the process. And that's what they think, that you can consciously guide evolution, and you do this by engineering your conflicts. And so we find the idea of preemptive war gaining ground and becoming popular as social Darwinianism was on the rise. Preventative wars, preemptive wars, they're all central to the evolutionary development of humanity.
That seems like a contradiction, an inherent contradiction. I mean, here we are, supposedly, the product of millions of years of natural selection, and now we're supposed to help the process along by shooting at each other?
Absolutely. And if it were just an objective scientific fact, if it were just a natural, deeply embedded teleological principle of the universe itself, why on earth do we think it needs our help to guide it along? Yet nonetheless, this is where Darwinian thinking has taken us.
Well, it's like what we say in our section in the book over the IMF and the World Bank, which part of the conditions for their bailout money is basically the stripping of infrastructure. What we discovered with that is that there's very little natural about natural selection.
Yeah.
We find this faction of the elite. We have this one faction of the elite right now, which we spoke about time and time again, but I think we are hitting on a missing dimension in the conversation concerning that faction today. The neoconservatives, they have made the centerpiece to their plan to establish a scientific dictatorship, preemptive war. And to those who believe the neoconservatives are some right-of-center group of born-again Christians, think again. Jesus may, in fact, be an important figure to these guys. Using him has certainly helped them recruit people to their cause and create a support base.
Mm-hmm.
But their Jesus is a re-engineered Jesus. And to qualify that contention, I direct people's attention to a cult that is part of the Neocons Network. And we speak about this cult at length in the new edition of the book. The cult is known as the Family, and this group boasts several congressional representatives and senators as part of their membership. They have formed prayer groups in the Pentagon and the DOD. They organized the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C.
Are they the guys that have that mansion overlooking the Potomac River in D.C.?
I think it's in Arlington. It's called the Cedars.
Yes.
I think it is.
Yes. Okay.
It's spoken about at length. A man named Jeffrey Charlotte has written an excellent article about it in an old issue of Harper's.
Indeed, I've read that article. Yeah.
Yeah, the date and the issue escapes me, and it was an excellent article. Wayne Mattson, who is former NCIS, naval officer who was working with the NSA, has written a little bit more about it and drawn out a little bit more. His problem, however, is that his left-of-center politics leads him to classify the group as a fundamentalist Christian group. In his Aided Task, which is a very good book that I'm reading right now, he goes a little bit into them, but his problem is that he relegates them to the realm of fundamentalist Christianity, and that's just not the case.
Right, he lumps all of us in with them.
Yeah, exactly. A little bit of the Hegelian dialectic at play there.
Right.
They're constantly invoking the name of Jesus, so I'll give that to Mr. Mattson. But the thing is that Mr. Mattson is not a philosopher, nor is he a theologist, and what you look at as you look into this group is that they reject the label Christian. They think that that label is too narrow for the world that they are building in Christ's name. So you look at the world that they're building, and you start to see that it is a worldly kingdom built with worldly power and arbitrarily labeled Christ's kingdom. Well, that's nothing more than the Gnostic concept of emanticizing the eschaton. So they have re-engineered Jesus into a kind of Gnostic figure. But the neocons are essentially, they're not right-of-center guys. They're not these fundamentalist Christians. They're essentially Trotskyist. Irvin Kristol, the godfather of neoconservatism, wrote in his book, quote, "I regard myself lucky to have been a young Trotskyist, and I have not a single bitter memory," unquote. Their concept of a global democratic revolution that President Bush has spoken about in several speeches is basically the Trotskyist Fourth International's idea of a permanent revolution. And what these leftists have done is that they are blending their Trotskyite beliefs with some Leo Straussian fascist additives and technocratic beliefs to form what can be described as a neo-Jacobinism. And the original Jacobins or Jacobins, I've heard it pronounced both ways, were Illuminist bred revolutionaries who brought about the French Revolution in 1789 and later the Jacobin dictatorship when they got rid of their Girondin cohorts and competitors. So the French Revolution was an early attempt at a scientific dictatorship. So what the neocons are is they are heirs to the French Revolution, and they are not heirs to the American Revolution.
They are heirs to the Jacobin heritage and the Jacobin tradition.
Yes, that's correct. And what the neocons have done is they have manufactured a phony war on terrorism to act as a pretext for their preemptive warfare. Now, that's not to say that the terrorism is phony. That is just to say the war against it is. And we see this with September 11th when, as I pointed out in my first book, The Hidden Face of Terrorism, a significant part of the national security apparatus was essentially switched off. It was operating fine right up until the day that it was, that the attacks occurred. It was...
In fact, wasn't it A.B. Buzzy Krongard, or who was it that said that it would actually be beneficial if Osama bin Laden were never caught?
That's correct. A.B. Buzzy Krongard, who was the executive director of the Central Intelligence Agency, but you have the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence, then you have the DDCI, the Deputy Director, and then you have the number three man, who is the executive director. When A.B. Buzzy Krongard used to be the executive director, he was executive director around September 11th, if memory serves me right. He has actually said to the press that it would be better if Osama bin Laden were never caught. And the reasoning that he gave for this is he said, well, essentially, if the man was ever caught or killed, then the different guys would be playing one-upmanship to take his place, and the fighting and the factionalism in Al-Qaeda would lead to more terrorist attacks, which is nothing more than transparent nonsense.
Yeah, if there were an internal contention like that within an organization, it would eventually atomize itself.
Right.
And evidently that has not happened with Al-Qaeda.
Well, the strategy with any terrorist group is to... If you chop the snake's head off, the body dies.
Mm-hmm.
So,
evidently, he just wants the serpent to continue to wiggle its way around the globe.
Yeah.
Which leads back to what you were saying that this neo-Darwinian belief, which has been transformed into a political belief system, is required in order to create the new man. I mean, the practice to justify the continual war needed to further these neo-Darwinian changes?
Absolutely. And again, it harkens back to what you said. It's an anti-entropic belief in that things are going to become better and better and better. It's that old Enlightenment religious faith and progress, ever moving ever upward, ever onward towards something better and better, paradoxically facilitated through the misery and pain and suffering inflicted through warfare. So, and again, that's the way these people think. Their belief systems and their religion itself is just this strange mix of paradoxes and contradictions. But nonetheless, somehow they reconcile these irreconcilable elements and develop some sort of coherent religion out of it.
But in the book, we point out that the former director of CIA, Robert Gates, in his memoirs From the Shadows, and Zbigniew Brzezinski have since admitted the role that they played in creating what we have in the Al-Qaeda threat. Because what they essentially did is they started to aid the Mujahideen in Afghanistan 6 months before the Soviet intervention, and that basically enticed the Soviet army to invade Afghanistan, which is what they wanted to happen in the first place. And when the Soviets invaded, it gave them a nice pretext to go in there and radicalize the population of Afghanistan. And this radicalization happened through textbooks that were given to Afghan school children that were developed early in the 1980s under a grant from the Agency for International Development that was given to the University of Nebraska, Omaha,
right,
and its Center for Afghanistan Studies. And these books taught children to count with illustrations showing tanks, with missiles, landmines. I'll give you an example. Here's a quote right out of one of the textbooks. Quote, "A Kalashnikov bullet travels at 800 meters per second. A Mujahid has the forehead of a Russian in his sight 3,200 meters away. How many seconds will it take the bullet to hit the Russian's forehead?" Unquote.
That's an education.
And developed at the University of Nebraska.
Yeah, you don't get that on Sesame Street.
No. The University of Nebraska, where the N stands for knowledge. Well,
exactly, something like that.
I can only say that because my darling wife, I should say, is a former student at the University of Nebraska. So, and
she
was
never read anything like that.
No, she did not. She did not. So, now how does transhumanism play into all of this?
Well, basically, transhumanism itself qualifies as the latest incarnation of Gnosticism. Transhumanism is a result of basically the ruling class religion trickling down and basically creating basically facilitating what the sociologist William Sims Bainbridge calls religious engineering, which is basically the skilled creation of new religions. And the one central theme that remains embedded in these several futurist sects that have subsumed the ruling class religion, the one bit of thematic continuity can be found in the idea of, again, man's inherent mutability, his ability to be changed, his ability to migrate beyond the condition of being human, thus tangibly enacting the Nietzschean mandate for humanity to overcome its own humanity, and thus becoming God. In essence, transhumanism represents a new incarnation of Gnosticism because, like Gnosticism, it expresses an overall derision for the physical human body, and for the human condition itself. Bart Kosko, who's a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Southern California, he espoused a core precept of transhumanism doctrine when he basically said, quote, "Biology is not destiny. It was just nature's first quick and dirty way to compete with meat. Ships are destiny," unquote. Now, in this transhumanist context, our biological condition as humans is analogous to hell, and technology is an instrument for immanentizing the eschaton.
Heaven and earth.
Transhumanism. Transhumanism's characteristic Gnosticism probably owes its existence to the movement's Darwinian premises. Darwinism is, in essence, again, a Gnostic myth. It's predicated upon the metaphysical claim that things created themselves, which is encapsulated within the thesis of abiogenesis. Mm-hmm. This metaphysical claim provides the foundation for the Gnostic doctrines of self-salvation and self-deliverance. In this case, self-salvation and self-deliverance are facilitated through convergent technologies program, nanotechnology, biotechnology, cybernetics. All these are used to basically move man beyond the condition of being man to something other than man. To it takes the Weishauptian concept of the machine invention and gives it an ominously literal context to it.
One of the things that we point out in the book is this idea of a technocracy that has become what one author called the panopticon singularity. And that's where the panoptic society that was started by social science is now made perfect through technology. And that's what essentially you're going to get with this whole movement, the idea of chips in humans and tracking devices in people that record our, you know, our...
Again, this is also like a core precept of the old technocracy belief system that originated in the Enlightenment, and that is that salvation, that humanity's overall ascent to greatness is attributable 100% to industrialism, to technology, and it's no less occult. Technology, the word itself is derived from the root word techne, which means craft. Well, of course, craft is a word that's also associated with witchcraft, mm-hmm. which is also associated with the word Wicca, which is associated with the word wicker, which means to bend, as in the bending of reality. And technology, they see it as an instrument for the bending of reality. And if you think I'm making this up, consider the words of Mark Petsky, who was the developer of virtual reality language, if I'm not mistaken. Mark Petsky basically says that techne, that sorcery, finds its outward expression in the modern era through techne, through technology, and that's basically where we've headed now. This process of secularization just represented a segue, a philosophical segue, a transitional period for the reintroduction of these of the older occult religions that originated in Mesopotamia well over 6,000 years ago, the ancient mystery religions that originated in Egypt, in Babylon. The idea of man becoming God, however, now augmented with the latest scientific and technological advancements. So basically, you have Nimrod's kingdom reconstituted all over again, only this time instead of built by brick and mortar and stone, now it's built with steel, with a microchip, with the cyber technology, with biotechnology, with cybernetics, nanotechnology. Is basically just an updated, upgraded form of occultism.
Everything old is...
Yeah.
Everything old is new again. Nothing new under the sun.
Yeah, nothing under the sun is new.
Yes. Well, Paul, Philip, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Oh, I was about ready to say if they can't get you to accept this by accepting their utopian vision of society, then they'll basically get you to accept it through the war on terrorism that's going on right now as a necessary evil. But just remember that Jefferson said that in government there is no necessary evils, that evil is only found in government's excesses.
And that is a good place at which to end. This time has gone by too quickly. Paul, Philip, where can people find a copy of The Ascendancy of the Scientific Dictatorship?
It's presently available at www.booksurge, all one word, booksurge.com. It will also be available through the other dot-commerce, Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
And if I may, I'm
currently collaborating with a friend writing under the pen name of Snow Moon, and the two of us are assembling a compilation of short stories, prose, and poetry, which will probably be available later on this July. It'll be entitled Expansive Thoughts. And those who are interested in creative writing, and especially in poetry enthusiasts who are sick of the typical postmodern fare that sounds like Allen Ginsberg in a knife fight with feminist bodybuilders might be interested in checking that out. Yeah, people will especially enjoy Snow's work, whose emotive and expressive style acts as the perfect foil to my more philosophical and satirical work. But a lot of the fiction and prose and poetry that will appear in it has also appeared in your own Stormy Night Fiction magazine. And
Taj Mahal Seeker
magazine.
Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to seeing that, and we look forward to talking with you guys again soon. Paul, David Collins, Philip Darrell Collins, thank you for being our guests on PID Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that takes us out. We are leaving St. Louis County. We're heading west.
Yes, our next program will come to you whenever that might be. Probably 1 week from tonight, next week, Monday. We hope. No promises yet until we get something. Because we will have to make a few trips back here in order to finish some last-minute projects in the house. So, by the way,
those of you who I think we talked about this, or at least posted a story, I honestly can't remember. The last week feels like it's a month long. We did find a home for Murphy.
Yes.
I think we had talked about finding a home for Java with our groomer, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But we have officially found a home for Murphy. He is living with five kids.
Yes.
A family that has five kids. He is being spoiled rotten from what we understand. And it's a sad state to imagine.
Yeah.
Poor Murphy.
He was so stressed that he was falling asleep on the lap of this. He was given as a birthday present to an 8-year-old girl, and he was asleep on her lap that very first night.
Yeah,
which
it is.
Well, we know Murphy, and Murphy does not take to people very easily. He's very cautious, especially around men. Clearly, he's taken to this young lady because he was asleep on her lap the first night,
mm-hmm.
and is sleeping on her bed and her sister's bed. I guess the two young girls share a bedroom, and so he's doing okay. And we appreciate your concern.
He's a pretty happy boy.
Yep.
And we are very, very thankful for everybody for all your prayers and your support. And we will speak to you again in about a week from the new bunker location.
That's correct. Until then, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye bye, everybody.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say loud and clear, a better day is coming soon, to get us out of here. Don't let the hard times get you down. Older days will disappear. There's a
and analysis on demand.
Mm-hmm.
This is PID Radio.